Vampires were crawling all over the 70s, each one hunting a different demographic and sucking it dry. Quaker Oats had cornered the kiddie market with Cap'n Crunch, so in March 1971, General Mills launched their own new breakfast character.
Don't be scared. I'm the super sweet monster with the super sweet new cereal, Count Chocula.
And it was super sweet. 33% pure, raw, uncut white sugar. In 1972, Sesame Street introduced...
Greetings. I am the Count.
Hi, Count.
Do you know why they call me the Count? Because I love to count things.
And those were just the vampires for kids. 70s adults had Frank Langella doing his sexy, gothic, romantic vampire thing on Broadway and in a movie adaptation. And even more so, there was George Hamilton later in the decade with Love at First Bite. But let's be honest, George and Frank were both a little on the pale side. What about vampires with, shall we say, a bit more color to them? Enter the B Team. B for bold. B for beautiful. B for bankable. B for black. The 70s introduced audiences to three of the biggest, baddest black vampires of them all. These cats came on the scene, and if they built a Mount Rushmore to the most badass bloodsuckers of all time, you'd see all three of these dudes staring down at you. Blackula. Blade. And Bill Gunn. And this is their story. Scary haunted homeschool. Hollywood started the 60s with Roman period pick Spartacus ruling the box office, and the decade continued to unfurl a string of mostly white hits. The absent-minded white professor, the white parent trap, the music white man, the sound of white music, my fair white lady, and a white man for all seasons. Then, in 1967, Sidney Poitier happened. That year, two Poitier vehicles, Guess Who's Coming to Dinner and To Sir With Love, both placed in the box office top 10, and a third 1967 Poitier piece, In the Heat of the Night, won 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Adapted Screenplay, and Best Actor. But the weird thing about Sidney Poitier movies? Not many black people saw them. Variety actually estimated that only about 30% of those movies' box office came from black audiences. You'd expect an endlessly underserved audience to meet Hollywood halfway and go see a Sidney Poitier movie 2, 3, 4 times. But the fact was, Hollywood didn't know how to sell movies to black audiences. Then, in 1969, black actor and writer Ossie Davis directed Cotton Comes to Harlem, a raucous crime flick based on the Harlem set crime novels by Chester Himes.
If I may, step into the sidebar with me, and let's talk a little about Chester Himes. Welcome to the sidebar. Pour yourself a drink, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about Chester Himes, because it baffles me that this writer does not have a series on HBO right now for his 8 Harlem-set Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson books. Written in the 50s and 60s, these raucous, violent books are absolutely some of the best crime fiction ever written, in the vein of Elmore Leonard, to be honest. Born in Missouri, later moving to Ohio, Himes served 7.5 years in prison for armed robbery, where he started writing. He was mentored by Langston Hughes and wound up writing short stories, novels, and moving to LA to work as a screenwriter, an experience that absolutely broke him with the amount of racism he was exposed to. He felt like it had completely and totally corroded his soul. He would later move to France, where he would live out the rest of his life. But he was one of the major literary figures in American letters. When he went to the Yaddo Artist Colony in the late 40s, his room was across the hall from Patricia Highsmith's. In Paris, he would spend time hanging around with Picasso, Malcolm X, Melvin Van Peebles, Richard Wright. He was compared to Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler. He might be the great American crime novelist of the mid-20th century. And yet today, even though he's had 4 movies adapted from his 8 Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson books, most of them were in the early 70s. A Rage in Harlem was adapted in the early 90s and had a lot of stars in it, but didn't go very far or do much for his reputation. In this age of infinite streaming content, where companies are hungry for the next big thing, it completely and totally baffles me that we don't have a Gravedigger Jones and Coffin Ed Johnson series somewhere out there today. If Elmore Leonard can have a Hollywood moment and get a run of films like Out of Sight, Jackie Brown, and Get Shorty, I have to ask, when is it going to be time for Chester Himes? Thank you for joining me in the sidebar. Let's return to our podcast, already in progress. Ossie Davis shot Cotton Comes to Harlem, adapted from Chester Himes' book, with a mostly black cast on location in Harlem, New York, where the Black Citizens Patrol provided set security, and extras were recruited from community theater. The movie has no moral, no lessons, and no preaching. It's just a good time. And white people were baffled. In the New York Times, Vincent Canby panned the flick, claiming that the mostly black audience he saw it with were
confused
because
their sympathies were with the movie's villain, played with lovely, stylish cool by Calvin Lockhart.
But these confused black audiences loved Cotton Comes to Harlem. It cost a little over $1 million to make and took in a cool $5 million in 3 months. This time, Variety estimated that 70% of that money came from black audiences. In Chicago alone, the movie's audience was estimated to be 86% black. Clearly, black people wanted to see themselves on screen, just like the rest of us, but they were tired of being preached to. Enter Melvin Van Peebles. He'd been making films and writing novels in France, where he got hired by Columbia to direct Watermelon Man, about a white man who wakes up black. This comedy did exceptionally well and earned Van Peebles a 3-film contract, which he rejected to make his independently financed flick, Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song. A 1971 kaleidoscopic stream of consciousness trip full of nudity, violence, bad jokes, good jokes, and lots of sex. What was it about? As Van Peebles put it, a brother getting the man's foot out of his ass. It was raw. It was raunchy. Van Peebles was a genius-level promoter, and it was a hit. And 95% of its audience were black. 2 months later, another movie exploded onto screens.
Shaft's his name. Shaft's his game.
A slick Hollywood private eye flick from MGM, directed by the black artist Gordon Parks and written by Sterling Siliphant, who had won an Oscar for writing In the Heat of the Night. Shaft starred Richard Roundtree, and while its budget was only $500,000, it also had the bonus of a marketing campaign designed by Chicago's black-owned agency, UniWorld. 80% of its audience were black. And they sent it to a $12 million high, making it one of only three profitable movies released by MGM that year.
Shaft. Hotter than Bond, cooler than Bullet. Rated R. If you want to see Shaft, ask your mama.
Suddenly, black was beautiful at the box office. In 1972 alone, 14 of what were now being loosely called blaxploitation movies got released. By 1975, Richard Pryor was hosting Saturday Night Live, Diana Ross was getting nominated for an Academy Award, and blaxploitation had become a dirty word. Ebony magazine asked if blaxploitation flicks were
culture or con game.
And the executive director of the Hollywood branch of the NAACP, Junius Griffin, who had actually coined the term blaxploitation in the first place, said, "These movies were warping our black children's minds with filth, violence, and cultural lies." He then went on to call blaxploitation movies cultural genocide. But calling these movies blaxploitation is a little bit misleading because it did not come in any one flavor. There were westerns like Buck and the Preacher and Black Gun, dramas like Georgia, Georgia, written by Maya Angelou and Ossie Davis's Black Girl. There were Jamaican imports like reggae flick The Harder They Come, psychedelic musical trips like Space is the Place, twisty thrillers like Melinda, coming-of-age films like Coolie High, revolutionary agitprop flicks like The Spook Who Sat by the Door, and so many action movies like Black Rage, Superfly, Hitman, Trouble Man, Hammer, Slaughter, Top of the Heap, The Final Come Down, Three the Hard Way, Foxy Brown, Gordon's War, Detroit 9000, and many, many more. All of them lumped under the generic term blaxploitation. But something seems to be missing. We've got crime movies, pimp flicks, street-level drug films, romances, comedies, coming-of-age movies, westerns, action movies. Right. Where's the horror? Trust me, people were working on it. Hard. Dimension Productions announced plans for a Black Dracula earlier in the 70s, but it fell apart. Then, a young black film grad from UCLA named William Crane showed up at Screen Gems looking to cadge some work directing Bewitched episodes. He had a little TV under his belt, but their head of production had an idea. Crane might be the solution to a problem a friend of his was having. So, he took him over to AIP, Roger Corman's legendary exploitation house, and introduced him to their head, Sam Arkoff. AIP was having money trouble, and Arkoff had a solution. Let's make one of those blaxploitation picks that were bringing in big cash. Only, let's make a horror one. Arkoff didn't have a finished script, but he had an idea. Black Dracula. And he had a title. Count Brown's in Town. Crane had doubts, but his mom told him to take the job and make it his. So he did. And like every producer who ever tackled Dracula, he had one giant problem. Who can play the Prince of Darkness? So far, there had really only been two. Bela Lugosi, who is an icon, and Christopher Lee, who was also an icon. How do you find an icon? The producers had already interviewed a bunch of black athletes, but none of them were right. They'd talked to a serious actor and veteran of television series Rawhide, Raymond St. Jacques, but he wasn't interested. Crane says they talked to Harry Belafonte, which sounds ridiculous that a star of that magnitude would even take a meeting about a low-budget Corman quickie, but who knows? Then, Crane saw a rerun of The Man from U.N.C.L.E. featuring William Marshall in a guest appearance, and he knew he had found his Dracula. William Marshall was a method actor, a veteran of Broadway and London stages,
He stood a towering 6'5" and had a voice that sounded like it came from the bottom of a well. William Marshall was the full package. The only problem? He hated horror movies. And as for blaxploitation, as he put it,
I had no wish to be a part of that exploitation.
Marshall was a Midwesterner who regarded his time as a black man in a white man's army as being a prisoner of war. His personal hero was Frederick Douglass, whom he had betrayed on stage numerous times. He was, as the Times of London put it, the best Othello of our time. He was not about to make Count Brown's in town for Roger Corman. But he agreed to meet with Crane, and maybe talking to a young, ambitious black filmmaker reassured him, because at a certain point, Marshall turned to Crane and said,
"Let's just make this straight."
He wanted to get rid of what Crane called the shuck and jive, make the hero an African prince, not a pimp, make the female lead the reincarnation of his lost love, give him dignity, give him gravitas, and give him a new title. Exit Count Brown and enter
Blackula.
Marshall also insisted on being involved in the rewrites.
I don't see Blackula as a fiend. He's really as much a victim as those he terrorizes. And in the end, he sacrifices himself for love.
What made Blackula work is that Crane and Marshall had each other's backs. AIP wanted Blackula's cape to have a red lining like Bela Lugosi's. Crane insisted it be gray because that
looked cooler.
AIP pushed for a more conventional take on the Dracula tale, but Marshall and Crane added a slavery backstory with a racist Dracula turning to African prince Mama Walde into a vampire when Mama Walde dares to ask him for help ending the international slave trade. Crane also pushed for a mixed crew, half black and half white, at a time when most Hollywood crews were all white. AIP and Samuel Arkoff, in particular, were not known as hands-off producers. They overprotected their investments, and as production began, they were breathing down Crane's neck, ready to pull the plug at the first sign of trouble. Every day, anxious AIP execs crowded in to watch the footage as it came in, and they immediately realized that Crane was giving them a very different movie than Count Brown's in town. And they liked it. And they backed off. They even gave Crane the extra budget he asked for some equipment that they weren't quite sure he needed. But at this point, seeing the dailies, they trusted what he was up to. And the reason they trusted what he was up to? William Marshall. As Crane said later, when they saw Marshall's on-screen presence, they knew they had something special. And the thing that seduced them the most? His voice. William Marshall's power lay in his voice. He called it his heritage. He was the grandson of enslaved workers, saying in interviews,
"My father and his brothers and sisters sang their way out of the plantation."
Marshall's first love was singing. He knew he had a great voice. And now that voice, that beautiful baritone voice, convinced AIP to back off and let he and Crane make the movie their way. Blackula starts in 1780 at Castle Dracula, where Prince Mama Walde, a Nigerian from the Ebonyi people, has come to ask Count Dracula to lend his support to ending the slave trade. But Dracula turns out to be a racist prick, and when Mama Walde calls slavery barbarous, Dracula purrs, "Barbarous from the perspective of the slave, perhaps. Delightful and intriguing from mine." Then he offers to buy Mama Walde's wife. A fight breaks out, predictably. Mama Walde gets turned into a vampire, also predictably, has his name taken away from him, and is rechristened Blackula. He gets chained up in a coffin, his wife is murdered, and he's torn away from his homeland and sent to America. 1780 was the peak of the transatlantic slave trade, and every single year in that decade, 78,000 black Africans were captured, stripped of their names, separated from their families, and sent on the long passage. They were transformed from free human beings into what was considered subhuman, below human, inhuman. I'm using that word very consciously because that is what we did. We turned humans into inhumans. As a human being, you were free. You had rights. You had agency. You had a past, a family, a community. But now, you were not human. You were property. You had no past. You had no community. You had no name. You were to be bought and sold, killed, maimed, or tortured at will, without any penalty. Many religious leaders now even considered that an enslaved person didn't even have a soul. Mama Walde awakens in Los Angeles in 1972, where he stumbles across Tina, played by Vanetta McGee, a modern woman he believes is the reincarnation of his murdered wife. The action of Blackula unfolds in Watts, Los Angeles's iconic black neighborhood. And, almost exactly 7 years before it came out, an incident of police brutality had sparked what became known as the Watts Riot, or the Watts Uprising, depending on your point of view. 14,000 National Guardsmen had been called in to stop the six-day battle that started with an incident of police brutality. It left 34 people dead and was the worst civil unrest in the city of Los Angeles until the Rodney King riots in 1992. It's no accident that Blackula is set in Watts, which had become shorthand for black resistance against the police. And it's also probably no accident that Tina is eventually killed by the police. Twice. Once as a living woman, and once as a resurrected vampire. As the police storm his lair, a grief-stricken Mama Walde ignores them. When one confronts him with a cross, he simply says,
"There's no need for that."
And the cop actually puts his cross away. Then, Mama Walde walks out into sunlight and commits suicide. The first time a vampire had done that in fiction since Varney the Vampire threw himself into Mount Vesuvius in 1845. And that suicide is enormously important to Blackula's story. Like Bram Stoker's Count Dracula, Mama Walde is cultured, elegant, educated, he's an aristocrat, he's charming. Now, with Count Dracula, that charm usually curdled when we learned that beneath the mask of his education and his civilization, Dracula is nothing more than a remorseless murderer who will kill anyone to preserve his own life. But not Mama Walde. He kills himself because he cannot live with having caused the death of the woman he loves. He cannot go on living this undead existence with what he's done. Unlike Dracula, he knows when the party's over and it's time to pay the bill. In the film, Mama Walde, or Blackula, exists in a very weird tension, however. Regal enough to make Chadwick Boseman's T'Challa in Black Panther look a little rough around the edges, when his bloodlust overtakes him, Mama Walde becomes downright feral, sprouting hair on his face, eyebrows expanding alarmingly as he snarls and the smell of blood drives him wild. He can't help himself. His hunger turns him into a savage creature. Inside this cultured, civilized man lurks a horny, rapacious beast. And there's no getting around the fact that this is a really toxic stereotype about black men, that their education and manners are just a thin veneer of civilization over an essential animalistic nature, that they will attack women sexually at the first opportunity, that no matter how civilized they are, when they're tempted, their primal needs come to the surface. In the hands of lesser filmmakers, this would be unforgivable. But William Marshall redeems this trope through his performance. He is genuinely anguished about his blood addiction, something that comes even more to the surface in the sequel.
Scream, Blackula, scream.
Marshall is a good enough actor to play not a stand-in for all black men, but a single man, tormented by vampirism, scourged by addiction. He's a man who has had his humanity stolen from him. And in the end, he takes responsibility for what he's done and, unable to live with himself, he chooses death. Exactly 4 weeks after Blackula came out and brought vampires from the misty castles of yesteryear into the teeming Los Angeles neighborhood of Watts,
Hammer Films tried to recapture their old magic by transplanting its Dracula franchise from the 19th century to modern-day swingin' London in Dracula, AD 1972, a movie that ends with Dracula getting tricked and falling into a pit of stakes. It bombed. But Blackula? Well, Marshall and Crane had convinced Sam Arkoff to go all in on what was supposed to be just another quickie. Doubling down based on what he'd seen in the dailies, Arkoff organized a word-of-mouth campaign through black fraternal magazines and journals. He made sure the Los Angeles and San Francisco premieres were held in black communities, and the black newspaper, the LA Sentinel, carried a two-page spread about the launch. Marshall followed the film across the country on a 21-city publicity tour. In its first 8 months, Blackula grossed almost $13 million, making it the highest-grossing movie in AIP history. To celebrate, AIP ran variety trade ads proclaiming,
"He's Blackula. He's beautiful. He's box office."
And now, let's adjourn once more to the sidebar. Blackula had another side effect. Junius Griffin, the NAACP president who had called blaxploitation movies cultural genocide, even as he coined the phrase blaxploitation movies, seems to have lost his job because of Blackula. This is not something I'm altogether sad about, because in 1964, Junius Griffin wrote a series of stories in the New York Times about a Harlem gang known as the Blood Brothers. His article said that this gang roamed the city, attacking white people. "The new gang has no turf to protect," the Times hyperventilated, "and its targets know no geographical limitations. It is the white man." What made them especially dangerous, these Blood Brothers? In the 6 weeks since the riot, the Blood Brothers have intensified their training in karate and judo fighting methods. And what else about the Blood Brothers? They didn't exist. Griffin had completely fabricated them. No one who looked into them, civil rights activists, journalists, even Griffin's boss, could find a shred of evidence that they ever existed. But the Times didn't retract the story. They refused to back down. They had their reporters back. And the result? The Blood Brothers may have been fake, but what happened next was real. The panic that was stirred up in part by these articles in the Times, and the fact that they were picked up on the wire service and reprinted in newspapers across the country, put hundreds of extra cops on Harlem street corners, on high alert for these karate-killing Blood Brothers. That summer, Harlem became occupied territory. And a few months later, predictably, it erupted into violence. One person killed, 118 injured, 465 arrested. Now, in 1972, when Blackula was coming out, Griffin was the head of the Beverly Hills branch of the NAACP, and although I cannot be 110% sure he lost his job over Blackula, here's what seems to have happened. All that summer, the actor Anthony Quinn had been pissing off Black America by developing a project in which he would play King Kristoff, the leader of the Haitian Revolution, in a prestige biopic. To play this hero of Black resistance to slavery, Quinn would wear blackface. This was not a popular idea, but Quinn accused any naysayers of practicing segregation themselves, or oppressing him. He ended one letter saying that he needed to play King Kristoff because he understood the part, and someone needed to bring this hero to the mask, and if he had to wear blackface to do it, well, isn't that just acting? His last line of that letter? "If not me, who?" Well, as his naysayers replied, how about Sidney Poitier, James Earl Jones, Ossie Davis, or how about, as the magazine Black Scholar suggested, William Marshall? As the release date of Blackula crept closer, Junius Griffin decided it was time to weigh in on this debate that was taking up so many column inches in the newspapers, and so he wrote an op-ed in Variety, as he was wont to do, saying, "If black actors can play demeaning roles in Blackula, I can hardly oppose Quinn's portrayal. I feel he would bring dignity to the role." No one was having it. There was an enormous gulf, they pointed out, between William Marshall, the greatest black Shakespearean actor since Paul Robeson, playing a figure of, quote, heroic black resistance, as they said in the press, and Anthony Quinn donning blackface. By September, after these comments had been published and an outcry had ensued, Griffin was no longer the head of the Beverly Hills chapter of the NAACP. You can draw your own conclusions. Thank you for joining me in the sidebar. Now let's return to our podcast, already in progress. Crane and Marshall made Blackula better than it should have been. They found dignity in it. And finding dignity in unlikely places seemed to be what happened when you unleashed black filmmakers and actors on unpromising material. And that brings us to our second face on this 70s Mount Rushmore of black vampires. Bill Gunn. Producers Quentin Kelly and Jack Jordan had formed Kelly Jordan Enterprises, a fledgling production company specializing in elevated material for black audiences. They planned a biopic of Patrice Lumumba and an adaptation of Maya Angelou's I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And they also had another movie in mind, one that might be a little more box office friendly. And that's where they brought in Bill Gunn.
Kelly Jordan called me in to write a film. He said, "Don't be embarrassed because it's a horror film, the first black horror film. It's going to be fabulous, and I'm embarrassed to say it to you." And I started to say, "You should be." So he invited me to write it.
Was it an original story?
Well, they came up with some ideas. They had a script first written by a very good filmmaker and writer, but it wasn't exactly right. So they said, "Well, come up with the script and any ideas that that we might want to buy." So they said, "Have you done any film?" And I said, "Well, yes, I have. I just finished directing a film called Stop, and that's exactly what it did." It wasn't released, and also there was a cut of my cut of Stop. So I took him over and showed him Stop. After seeing it, he asked me to direct.
Gunn was a gay black high school dropout. He'd studied method acting and become good friends with James Dean, whom he'd understudied in one of his stage roles. Acting led to writing, and after getting a few plays and novels under his belt, Gunn started writing screenplays, his best known at the time being The Landlord, the first film directed by Hal Ashby, who had an Oscar on his mantle for editing Sidney Poitier's In the Heat of the Night, and who would go on to direct new Hollywood classics like Harold and Maude and Shampoo with Warren Beatty. Gunn had been tapped to direct Stop for Warner Brothers, making it the second studio picture helmed by a black director. Shot by Owen Roisman, who would go on to shoot The French Connection and The Exorcist a few years later, Stop told the tale of two couples falling into a debauched four-way sex quadrangle in Puerto Rico. The film was taken from Gunn, re-edited, given an X rating by the MPAA, and eventually shelved. Later, Warner Brothers claimed its negative had been lost. They were lying. But still, no one was able to see Stop. Now, Gunn embarked on this new vampire picture for Kelly Jordan, which he called Ganja and Hess. Budgeted at about $350,000, he started shooting on Super 16mm at a farm in upstate New York, and Jordan and Kelly, as he did, heard that one of their big productions, I'm guessing Honey Baby, Honey Baby, a Diana Sands, Calvin Lockhart international comedy thriller, was spiraling into disaster. So they rushed off to save it, leaving Gunn to his own devices. And Gunn, he had plenty of devices.
"I'm not really interested in horror. I'll tell you why. It used to frighten me when I was a child. But since I understood it, it no longer frightened me when I found out what it was all about."
"What's it all about?"
"Sex. That's the vampire's trip. Its body stripped of their souls, their guilt, everything.
Jordan and Kelly returned from saving their international production in trouble, took a look at Gunn's finished film, Ganja and Hess, and... well, they weren't sure what the hell it was, but it was definitely not what they were expecting. They opened it at New York City's Playboy Theater in 1973, and 3 days later, it was doing so little business that the theater returned the print. Bill Gunn tried later in an interview to figure out where it went wrong.
I think it had never happened before from a black director, so they weren't ready for it, and the studio didn't have the money to exploit it.
But Ganja and Hess is no more aggressively experimental than Melvin Van Peeble's Sweet Sweetback's Badass Song, released 2 years previously, and that movie became a huge hit. Gunn also blamed the lack of black support for his film's failure.
White writers were writing pieces on it, but no black writer wrote anything. Finally, Paul Carter Harrison wrote a piece in Players Magazine, and I think Clayton Riley wrote a piece. Black writers weren't writing about it, and we really needed our black audiences at that time.
Not quite true. James Murray, the influential critic at the Amsterdam News, New York City's major black newspaper, had declared Ganja and Hess the most important black-produced film since Sweet Sweetback. And at the time it was released, Gunn was furious about what white critics had to say about his movie, not black critics. The New York Times reviewer A.H. Weller had called Ganja and Hess
a confusingly vague melange of symbolism, violence, and sex that leaves a compassionate viewer with a pressing need for fuller explanations.
Gunn fired back in a letter to the editor.
There are times when the white critic must sit down and listen. If he cannot listen and learn, then he must not concern himself with black creativity. One white critic left my film, Ganja and Hess, after 20 minutes and reviewed the entire film. A.H. Weller states in his review of Ganja and Hess that a doctor of anthropology killed his assistant and is infected by a blood disease and becomes immortal. But this is not so, Mr. Weller. The assistant committed suicide. I know this film does not address you, but in that auditorium, you might have heard more than you were able to over the sound of your own voice. Another critic wondered where was the race problem, but if he looks closely, he will find it in his own review.
Ganja and Hess failed at the box office probably because, like 2001 A Space Odyssey, when it came out, no one knew what the hell to make of it. 2001 A Space Odyssey was saved, however, by marketing maven Mel Moran's last-ditch campaign, calling it the ultimate trip that turned it into a psychedelic must-see for hippies. Ganja and Hess wasn't so lucky. So, what exactly is Ganja and Hess? Scored by Sam Wayman, Nina Simone's brother, and shot by James Hinton, the celebrated black photographer who became famous as the first man to refuse to lighten black skin on film. Ganja and Hess is, like Carl Theodore Dreyer's 1932 classic Vampire, more of a mood than a movie. Dr. Hess Green, doctor of anthropology, doctor of geology, while studying the ancient black civilization of Merithia, was stabbed by a stranger 3 times, one for God, the Father, one for the Son, and one for the Holy Ghost. Stabbed with a dagger, diseased from that ancient culture, whereupon he became addicted and could not die, nor could he be killed. Hess, played by Dwayne Jones, star of Night of the Living Dead, lives in a palatial mansion in upstate New York, and from there he ventures out looking for blood to stay alive. His new assistant, George Maida, played by Bill Gunn himself, shows up and turns out to be deeply depressed. His first night on the job, he tries to kill himself by tying a noose to a tree in Hess's front yard, then climbing up into its branches to consider suicide, and he is very drunk.
I'm neurotic, okay?
What does that mean,
I'm neurotic? Actually, it means that this hasn't got anything to do with you. Yeah. Okay. May I have it?
Yeah.
Thank you. I need it.
It has nothing to do with me.
No.
Except that it's my tree and my rope. You see, that will give the authorities the right to invade my privacy with all sorts of embarrassing questions.
Dr. Green, actually, I thought to throw myself in one of your lakes, but I have an absolute horror of drowning.
Thank God your horrors outweigh your manners.
I tried not to involve you.
Mr. Mather, there's no possible way for you to know this, but I'm the only colored on the block. You see, and if another black man washes ashore around here, you can believe the authorities will drag me out for questioning. Will you please come out of that tree?
Maida does eventually manage to kill himself, and his wife, Ganja, played by Marlene Clark, shows up in a mood. She wants to know what the hell happened to her husband. And she discovers Hess, hiding her husband's corpse, then doesn't seem to really care much and starts an affair with him. Not the corpse, with Hess. There are a few more plot points, but nothing that sounds very impressive on paper or that I want to tell you because it just sounds pretty straightforward. But Ganja and Hess is anything but straightforward. It assembles itself out of a pulsating collage of seemingly unconnected scenes. Hess's murder of a single mother, then walking out of her apartment while her abandoned baby howls in the background, gets repeated and refracted throughout the film. There are more images of nude male bodies than you'll find in a museum full of classical Greek statues. And at one point, Marlena Clark delivers an astonishing monologue by Ganja about her relationship with her mother.
I said, we were all chasing each other because we were having a snowball fight. And she said, you are a liar and a slut. And I said, I swear to you that I was having a snowball fight. And she didn't believe me. She never believed me. It was as though I was a disease. I have a brother that's 10 years older than I am. I have a sister that's 8 years older than I am. So that I was obviously an accident. And it was Ganja. I came down with Ganja, you know. And I think that day I decided that I was a disease.
Ganja gets turned into a vampire in the film and talks about her own murder as a, quote, strange dream. And throughout, Ganja and Hess refuse to feel guilt about killing people to feed their addiction. I will not be tortured, Hess says. I will not be punished. I will not be guilty. But he does feel guilty. Like Mama Walde and Blackula, Hess is finally overwhelmed by the horror of what he's become, and he takes the ultimate responsibility for his vampirism. Ganja, on the other hand, chooses a different road. Ganja and Hess is beautiful and boring and ecstatic and down to earth and religious and nihilistic and fascinating and tedious, and there is nothing else quite like it. So, it's no wonder that Kelly Jordan didn't know what the hell to do with it. So they sold it after it came back from the Playboy Theater to a company called Heritage Empire, who hired Fema H. Novak to re-edit it into Blood Couple, a version of the movie that's 33 minutes shorter than Bill Gunn's cut, but also includes 15 minutes of alternate takes and footage not seen in Bill Gunn's cut. This 78-minute version of Ganja and Hess would be released and re-released in theaters and on home video as Black Evil, Black Vampire, and Black Out, the moment of terror. Many, many years later, Ganja and Hess would be restored to Bill Gunn's original vision. But that was many, many years later. Gunn's masterpiece had been massacred and was out on the market as something he couldn't take responsibility for, as a cheap horror flick he loathed. And what saved his life is something he mentioned in his letter to the New York Times.
If I were white, I would probably be called fresh and different. If I were European, Ganja and Hess might be that little film you must see. Because I am black, I do not even deserve the pride that one American feels for another when he discovers that a fellow countryman's film has been selected as the only American film to be shown during Critics Week at the Cannes Film Festival this May of 1973. Not one white critic from any of the other major newspapers even mentioned it.
He's right. They didn't. But Ganja and Hess did play Cannes and reportedly received a standing ovation. Josephine Baker, the famous singer and performer, talked it up wherever she went at the festival, trying to get the movie more attention. Gunn said that this European reaction stopped him from, quote, going out on himself, which I think may be a reference to suicide. After all, he kills himself in Ganja and Hess. The Critics Week jury at Cannes also named Ganja and Hess one of the 10 most important American films of the 1970s. And they're right. It is. Ganja and Hess stands alongside other singular 70s achievements in cinema like Francis Ford Coppola's The Conversation, Orson Welles's F for Fake, Terrence Malick's Badlands, Toby Hooper's The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, or Stanley Kubrick's Barry Lyndon. Visionary movies that seem to come out of nowhere, that seem to have no precedence, that stand alone in their directors' careers. These movies are movies that are more than the sum of their parts, movies that defy conventional plot description, movies that are less about something and more a movie where something seems to be speaking through them. What is Ganja and Hess about? That's the question. Critics say it's about
racial representation, cinematic tradition, sexuality, confronting contemporary African-American Christian roots with pre-Christian African roots, a deconstruction of the male gaze, an attempt to overthrow all systems, including those which shape how we think about race, construct images, and tell stories.
I don't buy it. At one point in a later interview, director Bill Gunn tried to sum up his intentions.
I saw the character trapped in a vampire movie. I saw Dwayne now wandering through this horror film, trying to find his way out, and when I look back to see what it's all about, that's really what it's all about. It's a much more interesting character who is trapped in a trivial situation.
I don't buy that either. Every thesis that Ganja and Hess sets up gets kicked over in the next scene. Every philosophical statement it makes gets undermined by another one. Maybe we should take Gunn at his word when he says, as George Maida, philosophy is a prison. It disregards the uncustomary things about you.
By the Christians it is written that in the Black Marathon age there existed an addiction to blood among its people.
Like David Lynch's Eraserhead or Alain Resnais's Hiroshima Mon Amour, Ganja and Hess is a multifaceted contradictory object, fully realized in three dimensions, that pulls you into its maze. And as you wander its halls, you realize that it isn't about anything at all. It is the something that it is about. It is his own statement that no explanation can accurately summarize because every explanation has to ignore some other aspect of the film. Its sense of humor, its sexiness, its obsessions, its violence, its roots in horror, its Christianity, its atheism. It is unique. It simply is. And that is the very definition of art.
The only thing that I'm compelled to do is make my images true to my imagination. That's all. The black audiences has to learn how to see its artists, to listen to its artists. Don't turn your artists into politicians.
The blood of
70s blaxploitation added a third figure to the pop culture canon, another mighty face carved into the Mount Rushmore of these three black heroes of 70s vampire culture. But this one was loud and brash and full of brass. He came across almost like a comic book. And that's because he was born in one.
Drop that girl, Dracula, or this wooden knife will finish you off forever! Maybe you're hot stuff back in Transylvania, but nobody messes around with Blade, the Vampire Slayer!
When I was a kid in the 70s, my grandparents had a stack of comic books in their house. They were missing covers, their pages were coming apart, but between those issues of Weird War Tales and Mr. Miracle and The Brave and the Bold, I loved the copies of The Tomb of Dracula the most. And what I loved most in Tomb of Dracula was when Blade showed up.
Blade!
It ain't John Shaft, Red Eyes!
A big John Studd blaxploitation character parachuted into the shadowy, fog-milled, misty, Hammer-filmed-inspired menace of Tomb of Dracula, Blade didn't respect anyone. He spoke for the audience when he pointed out that Dr. Van Helsing's modern-day gang of vampire killers may be in a fight for their lives to save the world from the menace of Dracula, but they never seemed quite able to close the deal.
These vampires were members of Dracula's Legion. They would have led me to him.
Then what, Pops? You've been dancing around with the Count long enough!
There would be no dancing, Mr. Blade. My organization has weapons powerful enough to destroy Dracula.
Tell me more, Harker. Like how you've been failing to do that one little thing for 60 years.
Damn, those are some third-degree burns, Blade. But you know what? Blade doesn't care.
You just killed a teenager, Blade.
That's Mr. Blade, Harker. And frankly, I don't give a flying hoot. He was a stinking vampire and better off dead.
Even better, while the rest of the cast shook in their booties at fear of Dracula's might and power, Blade didn't take any lip from Count D.
Wish to try again, Braggart? Or do you acknowledge Dracula as your master?
You can stuff it, man. Blade calls no one master, dig?
Strong, rude, and full of attitude, Blade rocked. By 1971, Marvel Comics was in an arms race with their rival DC. They fought over pricing, they fought over format, and when DC started releasing horror anthology books, Stan Lee at Marvel demanded that they develop their own vampire character. So, in April 1972, a few months before Blackula hit movie theaters, Marvel released Tomb of Dracula Number 1, about the descendants of Quincy Harker and Dr. Van Helsing hunting Dracula in the modern day. And it wasn't very good. Writers bailed ship every other episode. No one much cared about it. So finally, the poison chalice of Tomb of Dracula got passed to a guy named Marv Wolfman, who was young and up-and-coming and not about to say no to a regular series. He was paired with artist Gene Colan, and Wolfman did what every other writer did on Tomb of Dracula. He flailed. And it didn't help that he wasn't much of a vampire guy in the first place. But then, Wolfman reread Stoker's original Dracula, and the lightning of inspiration struck.
There was no template for how to do a horror series. The good guys were not the star of the book. Therefore, they could live, they could die, it could change, they could be scared, could be altered, could feel utter frustration. It was a place to do stories that I had never seen done in comics before. There had been no horror series, in fact, prior to this, that I was aware of. EC, which was considered the best of all the horror comics, were all 6- and 8-page horror stories with no continuity.
Wolfman turned Tomb of Dracula into a Dark Shadow-style soap opera, starting with issue number 7, although he says he hit his stride with issue number 10, which, coincidentally, is the issue that introduced Blade, the vampire hunter. Wolfman had actually wanted to introduce a black character to comics when he worked at Warren back in 1968, but he never got the chance. Now, however, he had his vehicle. Subconsciously, he said he was influenced by blaxploitation movies, and he and Colan came up with someone who looked heroic, and like he stepped right out of a blaxploitation movie poster. A black man with a goatee, wearing boots, a bandolier of wooden blades and stakes, a leather jacket, and wraparound shades. Basically, it was like Jim Brown dropped into a mistily mysterious Hammer vampire film. And it was awesome. Blade leaps into action in Tomb of Dracula number 10 and immediately kills a couple of teenage vampires without even breaking a sweat. Later in that same issue, Dracula sets a bomb on a cruise ship and Blade orders the passengers to dive into the water. "But I can't swim," one whines. Blade throws him overboard. An issue later, Edith Harker, Mina Harker's great-granddaughter, gets turned into a vampire by Dracula and her father has to stake her to death. "Have the funeral later," Blade tells him. "Right now, they need to go after Dracula." Time and again, Blade beats Dracula's butt until Dracula must flee the battlefield. He actually manages to kill Dracula a couple of times, although the arch-vampire always gets revived somehow. Blade trash-talks Dracula relentlessly, puncturing the air of stately menace that permeates non-Blade issues of the comic like a suffocating mist, even though his insults can sometimes become downright incomprehensible.
"Pin the tail on the donkey, Fangface, because that's exactly what's coming off tonight."
I don't even know what that means. It doesn't matter. It sounds awesome. And Blade rocks. He's such a bad mother that eventually the only foe who can go toe-to-toe with him is a vampiric doppelganger of himself. And he also has a soft side. Turns out that he's not after Dracula at all, but instead, Blade is relentlessly hunting Deacon Frost, a white-haired mad scientist vampire who murdered Blade's pregnant mother while she was giving birth to Blade. When Blade was born, he didn't even cry. And he hasn't cried since.
"Maybe I'm just saving it all till after I find that stinking mother killer. Yeah, maybe then I'll be able to cry. Maybe then."
Maybe then, Blade. Maybe then. When Blade's not hunting Deacon Frost or busting Dracula's chops, he lounges on a suspended platform covered in fur, drinking a martini and carving wooden knives in his pad with a groovy nightclub singer lady, Saffron, with one F. Despite the fact that Blade occasionally brings a vampire hunt to a halt to make sweet love to Saffron with one F, he does eventually kill Deacon Frost. Strangely, he doesn't cry. Instead, he helps a friend out with a little vampire problem they're having and realizes that while his lifelong quest to kill Deacon Frost is over, killing vampires is something that will never get old, and he needs to embrace his true nature and continue to kill non-Deacon Frost vampires in order to have purpose in life. When Blade appeared in Tomb of Dracula, he was so popular he almost always got featured on the cover, and it came with blurbs like,
"Extra, the fear-fraught return of Blade the Vampire Slayer. A very special issue. Blade fights alone. This is it, the most requested story of all. Blade the Vampire Slayer battles Hannibal King the Vampire Detective."
The final 9 issues of Tomb of Dracula peter out, with Blade merely appearing in the background of a couple of panels as Dracula goes to hell, goes to New York City, fights some superhero dude who might be his child who's been super-aged and accelerated, I can't quite tell. He fights his daughter, he then fights Quincy Harker, and the two of them die in an explosion that closes out the comic book. It's a bit of an anti-climax to see Blade take a background role in the final issues, because he is the baddest, most stylish vampire hunter of them all, and he really did suck up all the oxygen when he appears in Tomb of Dracula. But the end of the comic book is not the end of the Blade story. In fact, it's not even the most important part of Blade's story.
What is the most important part of Blade's story?
Blade would have guest parts and walk-on roles in comic books for years, but by the mid-90s, Marvel Comics was in trouble. They were almost in bankruptcy. They'd sold Spider-Man and the X-Men to Sony. They'd sold Iron Man and Blade to New Line Cinema, the scrappy independent studio that had turned itself into a powerhouse with the Nightmare on Elm Street franchise. And now, New Line wanted to do an under $10 million superhero movie that would be, quote, tough and street, like Juice, kind of a hip-hop Marvel movie, they claimed. A young screenwriter with some Jean-Claude Van Damme movies under his belt named David Goyer had another idea. He wanted to make a trilogy.
"So I came in and said, I'm going to pitch you the Star Wars of black vampire films. I pitched it as this racial animosity between the purebloods and the turned vampires, the young Turks like Deacon Frost. And at the same time, I wanted to talk about race in a subversive way. And it played into this half-breed idea, if you will, to have one foot in each world and not be accepted by either one.
Mike DeLuca, head of New Line, told Goyer, "I'll make it for $40 million if you can get Denzel, $35 million if you can get Wesley Snipes, and $20 million if you can get Lawrence Fishburne." Goyer wanted Snipes. And it's hard to remember how big Wesley Snipes was in the 90s. His manager had once been told by a studio executive that they would never hire, quote, anyone darker than Denzel. And Snipes was darker than Denzel. But now, Wesley Snipes was opening action movies alongside Sylvester Stallone. He was acting in films opposite Robert De Niro and Sean Connery. He did Spike Lee movies, and they all grossed big. And Wesley Snipes loved comic books. He'd been attached to a Black Panther movie that had stalled out due to legal issues around the film, but that was around the same time the Blade train started picking up steam. And so Snipes hopped on board. His managers thought he was crazy, because it's hard to remember how small Marvel was in the 90s. Bankrupt, most of their valuable assets sold off all over town, the last Marvel movie had been Howard the Duck in 1986, and that had flopped so hard it ruined the careers of the entire cast. In fact, by the 90s, comic book movies were truly toxic. Sure, Batman had been a hit back in 1989, but by 1995, the Batman franchise had nipples and was a joke. Dick Tracy the movie had flopped, The Rocketeer had flopped, The Shadow had flopped, Judge Dredd had flopped, The Phantom had flopped, but Snipes hadn't gotten where he was by playing safe. He wanted to do Blade, and he agreed to cut his $10 million salary to $8 million for the movie, and he got to work. And Wesley Snipes was right. Blade grossed $70 million on its $45 million budget and earned again that much internationally. Even more importantly, it gave other filmmakers and studios the confidence to launch the X-Men movies, which were followed by the Spider-Man movies, and the rest, as they say, is history. Blade is ground zero in the Marvel Cinematic Universe that basically owns multiplexes these days. It would be 4 years before there was a Blade sequel, however, because as Snipes says,
"We wanted to make the baddest, hippest, most daring comic book movie we could make."
Guillermo del Toro came on board to direct, Hong Kong's Donnie Yen was brought in to do the action, and the final fight took 5 days to shoot. By the time it was over, Snipes had been stabbed through the hand, torn cartilage in his knee, and gotten a gruesome cut on his nose, which is not where a movie star wants to get cut. But Blade 2 opened to twice as much as Blade 1 and became another huge hit. Next up, Blade 3, known as Blade Trinity. And it was not so much of a hit. Goyer took over directing duties and things got bad fast. Claims were made that Snipes resented the attention going to his co-stars Ryan Reynolds and Parker Posey. Goyer attributes the mayhem to Snipes' acting style.
"There's always been a little bit of drama on the Blade sets. It became clear to me that Wesley is a very method actor. When he's doing a Blade movie, he is Blade, and he acts like Blade. Blade is edgy and bristly."
How edgy and bristly? Well, Snipes reportedly tried to strangle Goyer on the set. Goyer hired strip club bouncers as a private security team, and eventually Snipes would only communicate with him via post-it notes. That edgy and bristly. When the movie was over, Snipes wrote a 5-page letter to Bob Shea, founder of New Line, claiming that he'd only been told Goyer was directing 6 weeks before shooting began, and he had brought up doubts at the time that had been ignored. He said that his script approval had been undermined, that the humor was juvenile, that Goyer had refused to discipline a crew member who wore a t-shirt he found racially offensive, and that the predominantly white cast and crew made him feel isolated and excluded. No matter who you believe, the numbers didn't lie. Blade Trinity flopped. Blackula and Ganja and Hess succeeded on their own terms, largely because they had a mostly black cast and crew. Blade seems to have died because it didn't. All told, however, the Blade franchise made $1.5 billion worldwide and a combined $250 million on home video in the United States. It proved that superhero movies could make big bucks at the box office, it proved that adults would come out to see them, and, well, Spider-Man, Guardians of the Galaxy, The Avengers, Iron Man. Blade came first. In this episode, we've dealt with lots of firsts, a lot of pioneers and groundbreakers, the first black vampire on film, the second black man to helm a studio film, Marvel's first superhero movie, but now, I'd like to end this episode of Super Scary Haunted Homeschool by going back 200 years later to talk about another important milestone, but it's not someone who came first. See, we all know that John Polidori's 1819 story, The Vampire, was the first fictional vampire ever put down on paper. But have you ever asked yourself, what was the second? I'll tell you. It was a little story that came out later that same year, and its title? The Black Vampire. Published anonymously in June 23rd, 1819 in New York City, The Black Vampire is not only the second vampire story in Western literature, it's the first American vampire story. It's a response written to Polidori's story, which it cleverly refers to as the White Vampire, and it proved so popular that it received a second printing 2 months after it came out and was advertised for sale as far away as Charleston, South Carolina. Reading it today is a little tough. The Black Vampire is a naughty, insular work full of references to current events and pop culture of 1819. However, according to its anonymous author, it was written in 2 afternoons, so maybe that's why it has this feverish, intense energy all its own. Written as people in America freaked out over Missouri entering the Union as a slave state, and released in the wake of the Haitian Revolution, and set in Haiti, it's got a darkly sarcastic tone, constantly parodying white manners and customs as being ineffectual and totally baffling. The story starts with a Haitian slave owner, Mr. Person, buying a sick slave and trying to drown him when he proves disappointing and unable to get well. But the slave refuses to die and winds up tricking Mr. Person into being burned to death. Then, Mrs. Person, his wife, discovers their baby in bed, totally eaten, probably by a vampire, and nothing left of the baby but its skin, hair, and fingernails. Cut to, years later, Mrs. Person has remarried and buried 2 more husbands since her first, and then, suddenly, she's romanced by a black prince who's just walking along the beach one day when he bumps into her. He then turns her into a vampire, reanimates the original Mr. Person and the child who is the skin bag, but he also turns them both into vampires, then tells them that his white people, they're no longer welcome in Haiti. To show them why, he takes them to an underground cave where black men and vampires have allied to focus on, quote, the emancipation of the Negroes. The meeting becomes rowdy, and then soldiers burst into its location, staking and slaughtering all the revolutionaries. The underground battle is so violent that it shakes the earth itself, and the sleeping white people in Haiti believe that an earthquake has occurred. Surrealist and very, very stream of consciousness, The Black Vampire equates slaveholders with vampires, and the story alludes numerous times to the Panic of 1819, a devastating economic crash that was unraveling the markets when it was written. The drumbeat of economic insecurity runs throughout the story until it explodes in the conclusion, working itself up into a fiery state of anger as the author addresses the reader directly.
The accomplished dandy, who in maintaining his horses, his tailors, etc., absorbs in the forced and unnatural excitement of his senseless orgies the lifeblood of that wealth which his prudent sire has accumulated by a long devotion to the counter. What is he but a vampire? The fraudulent trafficker in stock and merchandise who, having sucked the whole substance of 100 honest men, is consigned for a few weeks to the sepulcher of the jail, and then, by the potent magic of an insolvent law, stalks forth, triumphant with bloated villainy, more elated in his shameless resurrection to renew his career of iniquity and of disgrace. What is he but a vampire? The corrupted and senseless clerk, who is being placed near the vitals of a moneyed institution, himself exhausted to feed the appetite of sharpers, drains in his turn the coffers he was appointed to guard. Is he not, I appeal to the stockholders, is he not a vampire? Brokers, country bank directors, and their disciples, all whose hunger and thirst for money, unsatisfied with the tardy progression of honest injury, by creating fictitious and delusive credit, has preyed on the heart and liver of public confidence and poisoned the currents of public morals. Are they not all vampires?
The author of The Black Vampire remains unknown. It's attributed to one Uriah Derrick Darcy, whom scholars believe is a pseudonym for maybe Robert C. Sands, an abolitionist, or also maybe Lydia Maria Child, another abolitionist, who happened to have authored the song we all know and love, Over the Hills and Through the Woods, To Grandmother's House We Go, etc. Some scholars believe it was authored by yet another abolitionist named Richard Varick Day, who would have been about 18 years old at the time, which, given the heightened emotions of the piece, sounds about right. But we don't know. And so it's entirely possible that its author could have been black. There's a history of black people writing anonymously in this country, or white authors taking credit for their work, but it's also bizarre enough in subject matter and political enough that it might be like Polidori's Vampire, written by an author who chose anonymity to preserve their reputation. We don't know exactly what the black vampire means, and if you read it, you probably won't either. But it features a black vampire who is a prince, and who demonstrates more elegance, dignity, and education than the white people he encounters. Like Mama Walde in Blackula, like Hess in Ganja and Hess. And like Ganja and Hess, maybe he doesn't have one explanation. I mean, it's not a math problem to be solved with a single pat answer. Maybe what you see in the black vampire reflects what you bring to the table. And that's another way you define art. What we know about it is this. John Polidori wrote the world's first vampire story in 1819 that established the image of the vampire as wild, decadent, gothic, and romantic. And 3 months later, someone else, who could have been black or white, a man or a woman, wrote the world's second vampire story, America's first vampire story. And it's about a black vampire. And it gave the world a vampire who is a prince, who is dignified, who is regal, who is a revolutionary. A vampire who is an abolitionist. A vampire who stands in opposition to the slave trade. A vampire who is killed, fomenting revolution against slave owners, who is conspiring to bring down the entire capitalist system. A vampire who is murdered by the police in his own lair. And when that happens, his death feels like the whole white world of capital and markets and slavery and bondage is shaking itself to pieces and falling apart around us. In this episode of Super Scary Haunted Homeschool, Troy Jennings played Bill Gunn. Nairobi Collins was Blade. John Dimes played William Marshall. And Chris LaMartina was the voice of David Goyer. The music you hear from Ganja and Hess was written and recorded by the legendary Sam Wayman. Super Scary Haunted Homeschool is produced by Chris LaMartina and Mike C. Walls. It's edited and engineered by Mike C. Walls. And it's written and narrated by me, Grady Hendrix.